accession number 21564, reel 23.
Colonel Cormac, reel 23. You were saying that you went out for short posting to Ireland.
Yes, it was about 4 or 5 months long, and those of us who were in the advance party, there was a reconnaissance first, advance party, and then a rear party. But it was the first time that we had a sapper regiment, if at any rate, had gone out outside its normal role, and we went as infantry. It was quite interesting. They had curious ideas of what size an infantry battalion should be. So we were made up with two additional squadrons. We left the divisional engineers back, that was the armoured engineers, amphibious engineers, and the field support squadrons, and we took two field squadrons, our own first and fourth, and we were joined by 5th and 42nd field squadrons from different divisions to make up a four-squadron regiment, which the powers that be thought would be equivalent to an infantry battalion of some 600, 700 men.
How did the strengths compare?
Well, we were slightly bigger in the end, but what it meant was that we had to, first of all, train for our new role as infantry, and secondly, we had to assimilate the two new squadrons into our command structure. That wasn't itself terribly difficult, but we had to know who the squadron commanders were, get to know them, get to know their squadron staffs, so that we could all work together and train together. It was fortuitous, in fact, that I had come from Warminster, the School of Infantry, so I was able to train the new regiment realistically in the infantry role.
How did the sappers respond to the idea that they were going to be deployed as infantry and that they were going to go to Ireland?
I think they were, 90% of them were absolutely intrigued with the idea and interested in the change of role. As a sort of sidelight, we had a number of Irishmen in the regiment, as indeed most units did. And one has to say that whilst they were in Northern Ireland, they performed their duties efficiently and loyally to the regiment, regardless of their personal background. It was interesting that after one or two had left the army and went back to Northern Ireland, that they polarized. The Protestants went to their own community, the Catholics went to their own community, and they totally polarized. But whilst they were with the regiment, they were completely neutral and effective members of the unit. Interesting little sidelight. Anyway, we got down to training the regiment.
Did you do that in Germany?
We got ourselves fit. I said the first thing is to be really fit, and we had a fitness training program. We had a weapon training program so that everyone was up to speed and beyond of their need for handling small arms and making sure that everyone knew that and could handle their weapons under any circumstances or provocation so that there would be no mistakes, that no one would fire accidentally and cause untold damage. So we did all that, and then we trained ourselves. We went up to various training areas, and there were some training with sort of urban, Imber village-type situations, where we were able to train as best we could on the best information we had how to handle riots. And we set up a squadron as a riot mob, and the others had to react sensibly and control the situation. And on the basis of what we learned in our reconnaissance, and this was 1970-71, it was almost entirely controlling the streets and controlling riots and riotous mobs. Other aspects were just beginning to come in, but that seemed to be the thing, that we had to sort these riots out. And essentially, we were working on imperial policing, as I had in Cyprus some 10 or so years before.
There was basic riot drills.
Riot drills, when you formed up with a in a square with a banner saying "Disperse or we fire." You had a photographer, you had a trumpeter or a bugler who would play calls, and you had someone acting as the magistrate who would say, "I'm empowered to order this," and then you would then go through all these motions. And if the mob didn't disperse, then depending on the situation, you would fire. It turned out very quickly, of course, that those drills were totally inapplicable to Northern Ireland, and then we had to find some other modus operandi, which we did, partly from information from the top and guidance from the headquarters, Northern Ireland, and partly from a common sense approach. But that was the interesting thing, how tried and tested drills in previous internal security operations were just couldn't apply in Ireland.
Why was that? What was so different about Ireland compared to, say, Cyprus?
Because partly you were dealing with, ostensibly, your own people. That was one very marked thing. And they did not behave in the predictable way, dare I say it, that ex-colonial nations tended to behave. And they were themselves becoming more organized. This is the IRA, and the, in those days, the provisional IRA were the main threat. They realized that just rioting in the streets wasn't going to get them anywhere. So they changed their tactics, and so did we. It was much more hit and run. They weren't at all fazed by a magistrate saying, if you don't disperse, disperse or we fire. That just didn't come into it. So we very quickly adapted a more pragmatic approach. And all the training we'd done in BOR enabled us to do that, to change slightly. And we had to get used to one of our squadrons in Lurgan, nearby at Portadown, one was in reserve, and one down in South Armagh, all had very different situations to handle. If you were in a place that was roughly half Catholic and half Protestant, that was one situation. If it was entirely Protestant, or almost entirely, as in Portadown, that was another situation. If you were in South Armagh, when it was 90% Catholic, you had to adapt to a different situation. So all our subunits really had to be ready for a different... You couldn't lay down a guidance.
Were you aware of that disparity of requirements before you actually arrived, or was that something that you learned when you were there?
We found that out very quickly, very quickly indeed, and had to adapt.
Mm. How did you deal with that? I mean, did you simply allow each squadron, field squadron commander, to make up his own policy and devise his own tactics?
A combination of guidance from our regimental headquarters, where I was in charge of all the operations prior to taking over, was very useful. And I had a good idea from fighting in built-up areas and internal security exercises in the old Imbra village. The other factor was, and I mentioned it elsewhere, was that all the platoon commanders and company commanders in the interim battalions that we were working with, I had known and indeed had probably trained. They all the platoon commanders knew me or knew of me, all the company commanders knew me, and that made it very, very easy to establish a working relationship, because they understood perfectly well that I knew what I was talking about. Whereas it might have been that some gunner, sapper, or armor corps coming in would not have that relationship, would take them longer to establish a trusting relationship. Anyway, whatever, I did find that a great help. And then we just got down to doing all these things and developing new ideas, and it became very clear that what we had to do at the beginning was all defensive. We were reacting to a riot, to an outbreak of terrorism, or some other situation. That there were very few occasions when we could take positive action to stop something happening or whatever.
What would you do then when a riot developed? You're saying that the old idea of the riot drill with the magistrate and the banner saying disperse or we fire was not applicable. So What sort of methods did you employ to try and contain large-scale disorder?
We had to pen them in certain areas because the whole country was divided up into areas where the Protestants were at home and in control, and then you had to divide up areas which were under IRA control, virtually. And the troubles tended to be on the borders of these areas.
So it's communal violence that was the main
threat. That sort of thing. And then where people necessarily had to move from one Protestant area to a Catholic area or vice versa were flashpoints. And they could erupt into violence, whether it was petrol bombing, stone throwing, that sort of thing, burning vehicles. What we tried to do was to contain them by having a means of blocking off streets, preventing them moving in certain directions by quick fences or barbed wire fences, which you could put up fairly easily. That was one way. And then, as I mentioned before, I could go up in a helicopter as long as the chap didn't mind circling around in ever-decreasing circles, as it seemed, which was excessively tiring, one has to say, both for the pilot and the observer, and then controlling our troops and say, look, they're going down such and such a street, they're obviously heading for so-and-so, and then we could boat around, block them off, that sort of thing, and try and damp it down that way. We spent a lot of time trying to stop people moving ammunition and explosives from one place to another.
Surely that depends upon having good intelligence, doesn't it? Of knowing who's going to be moving from where to where.
Yeah. And first of all, we relied on the police to tell us when trouble was arising, and then we had to rush out and deal with it. We set up a very good intelligence liaison with the local police. We gradually built up a picture of the known IRA, and that includes all the various sub-branches, PIRAs and so on, of personnel, and we built up a slow picture of their car makes and car numbers so that we could spot when they were moving, or try to. And as we got that information, they responded by changing car numbers, changing cars more quickly. But basically, it was intelligence. And then slowly, slowly, someone would say, we think something is moving from A to B tonight. Look out for this car and stop it. At the same time, we had regular routes that we set up roadblocks. And they would be set up for a varying period of time. You might go out and set it up from 11 till 1 o'clock in the morning. You might do it for less or longer. And then you stopped every vehicle coming through.
Was that intended to have a deterrent effect, or did you expect to find
it
contraband?
It was partly to find weapons, ammunition, explosives, possibly documents, although that was rare. And also, as you say, to deter people from moving around at night, which is the obvious time to do it. Mm-hmm. But they were moving any time, so you had to then reply by setting up roadblocks in daylight. Mm. It was quite interesting, the sort of things we discovered when stopping cars of all persuasions at night. Some of the things we found were quite interesting. That's another story. Then they became, or the opposition became, more adventurous. They would sometimes, if they were caught in the roadblock, they would just drive straight through at high speed. Then you had to say, right, how can we combat that? Mm. So we produced Calthorpes. These are these spikes that have always a spike facing up whatever way they fall on the ground. Then you had change of those that you would drag across the road on the other side of the roadblock, so that someone crashing through would hit those and puncture his tires and crash. Then rules of engagement became more formal. Various cards were produced which told everyone at the roadblock precisely what they could do and what they couldn't do, when they could open fire and when they shouldn't open fire. none of these guidelines were 100% foolproof. Whatever people did, there was always just that element of doubt about, and if you fired at the wrong time, of course, one or two people did in fact face prosecution for firing at the wrong time. Not, I would have thought in not 0.1% was that a deliberate chance to just to shoot at somebody. It was the uncertainty caused by the instructions not being 100% clear, which, under the circumstances, was extremely difficult to do.
You're saying that a lot of the trouble was between the two communities, Protestant community against Catholic community at that time, and you were trying to prevent mobs from moving around and trying to prevent weapons and ammunition being moved. Were there direct attacks upon your own troops at that time?
Very rarely. They're very rarely indeed. Most of the direct attacks were on the police. And during the time we were there, the police stations gradually became more like forts and fortresses. Most of the real attacks were on the police, either in the police station or in police patrols. We had, once we were deployed in the streets, then we were subject to stone throwing and petrol bombing, that sort of thing. But that was an ad hoc reaction to our presence. They didn't, at that stage, often attack army units. I think they were probably, at that stage, a bit worried about us firing back, because we had better weapons than they had. Mm-hmm. But that situation changed. Their equipment became much more sophisticated, their weaponry became more sophisticated, and indeed they had some weapons that we would have liked to have had ourselves.
Such as?
High-powered, high-velocity rifles, and machine guns. They had, their mortars were usually homemade. They had the odd rocket attack. They were, particularly in South Armagh, they did a lot of ambushing. Of normal troop movement, and then again you had to be thoroughly aware that you must not send vehicles and groups of people down a road at the same time every day. You had to vary timings and vary routes. Otherwise, you were going to be ambushed and suffer casualties. And indeed, there were so few routes that we could travel in that sort of way that they couldn't ambush. Some of the country lanes were so devious and twisting that you wouldn't use them for routine movement anyway. So you were always subject to it. And then we had to develop ambush drills. You had to look out for signs, cables, wires, all sorts of things that you develop. And then you had to clear the route before an important convoy went down. All these things were developed as a reaction to what was happening. We didn't have that before we started.
Well, how were your base areas protected against direct attack? What sort of measures could you protect them?
We didn't have too much at the beginning. We settled in our regimental headquarters in one squadron at a place called Long Kesh, which then became a prison. It was an old airfield, and all we had was the perimeter fence, which wasn't 100% secure. But there wasn't, as I say, much attack on us as army units. Some were in factories. I mean, I spent several nights in an old police station, lying on a sofa. At the beginning, the accommodation arrangements were very primitive for the massive number of troops that came in. So we had all that to deal with, but we did not at that time have the threat of direct attack. We expected it, but it didn't come at that time.
How was your regimental headquarters set up? What sort of facilities and arrangements did you have for controlling your squadrons?
We had an ops office, which was manned 24 hours a day.
That was in Long Kesh?
That was in Long Kesh. Mm.
What did you hatch? What sort of place was that in, and how was it furnished and equipped?
An old aircraft hangar.
You were in a hangar?
Cold and drafty. Much worse accommodation than the so-called IRA and other terrorists had in the prison. Much worse. They didn't know how lucky they were. It was cold and drafty, and But anyway, we all survived. We were camping. We didn't expect anything else, really. But we had the ops thing, and because what we were doing was setting up routine work. There's nothing worse than keeping people in one location or different locations standing by doing nothing. You had to find constructive things for them to do, whether it was just training or whatever. So we developed a system of patrols. We developed a system of setting up roadblocks by day and by night. We developed a system of putting a roadblock on the few motorways in Northern Ireland, because no one had done that before.
How do you go about doing that? That must be a formidable task, roadblocking a motorway.
Well, it was common sense, really, because anyone who'd driven on motorways in this country, and you come across the inevitable roadworks, you're faced with masses and masses of these lovely red and white cones.
Yes.
So we simply adapted what you would meet on a motorway in this country, where roadworks were taking place, and you were going down from three lanes or two lanes to one lane, and you gave them plenty of time by coning off and then protecting the sides to channel them into that one lane, where then you had your roadblock with your chicane and your call throps in case they went through at high speed. And we had to get police agreement to do all that. Almost anything that we did in the way of roadblocks, we had to have the cooperation of the police as well.
Were they generally cooperative?
They were. Yes, they were. They were. The better relationship we had with them, the easier it was to operate.
Did you find that they had a good intelligence picture of the enemy and their activities?
It varied a lot.
What, from place to place, or from time to time?
From time to time, they did have a good idea. Our intelligence officer, who went on to a very distinguished career later, he was a bit of Irish himself, and he set up a very good intelligence liaison with the police. And that enabled us to do quite a lot of tracking of vehicles and suspects that would not necessarily have come our way. So the intelligence link was absolutely fundamental to anything we did. Otherwise, it was just hit or miss, which a lot of it was. The one thing we began to develop in our time there was, I said, the one positive operation we could do was to search. And the
question is knowing where to search, though, isn't it?
You have to. We searched buildings that were occupied. We searched buildings that were empty. We had ideas about searching cars, lorries, articulated lorries, very difficult. You even had to be able to search a bicycle. Surprising, that may seem. You had to have techniques for searching individuals. You had to have a special technique for searching suspect ladies. Otherwise, you would be open to all sorts of problems. And so these ideas were all being thought of and put into practice, which you had to do with the local police and so on. And we didn't have much in the way of military police there that would help us. And there were, but there were some, and there were some women RMP that we could use. But the police force were the best source for that. And it was a patient business. Searching areas was incredibly boring. You had to cordon the whole area off, and then you ploughed steadily across without too much idea what you were looking for. Because we didn't know at that stage just how they would hide their weapons and stores of explosives and kit. We just searched the area and came across a building empty. We would search that and so on. But those techniques for searching got more sophisticated, and I'll come to that much later. But it could be interesting. And when we found something, of course, it lifted morale considerably. But we established a good relationship with the Royal Scots Greys, as they were then were, who were on the car. And they shared Gosford Castle with one of our squadrons. And so the idea came that they were also looking for positive things to do, that they would happily patrol in their armoured car an area which we were searching, a little roadblock here and point and patrol around with the armoured cars on the same radio wavelength and give us some idea that what we were looking for, or people we might want to see, didn't actually flit away.
Was that arrangement made on a sort of horizontal level, unit to unit,
Yes.
So it didn't come down from the top, command?
No, we just, as we were cohabiting, as you like. Yeah. And
you made up as you go, when you were making up as you went along at that stage.
There was a lot of that. Then, in addition to that, we were area reserve, so we had to know what we would do if we went to Londonderry, for example, because based where we were outside Belfast, that was the main thing. But we had to be able to whiz up to Londonderry should they need us. Mm. Well, we were never required to go to Londonderry, but we were frequently required to go into Belfast. And it would so happen that headquarters Northern Ireland would ring up and say, look, stand by. I'm sending you 6 Wessex helicopters. Mm. Be ready. You're going to the Dibbis Flats, and then we're going to cordon that area and search it. And for a suspect, and it's going to be done quickly. So I may say, came straight from General Farrar Hockley himself to me personally. The first thing I did was ring back his G1 and said, do you know what's happening? And he said, no. And then I told him, and then all was well. And then we had to be all ready, formed up in helicopter loads on the airfield, handy. And then the Wessex would all swoop in. We would load on. And then they would fly in. In the meantime, I would have gone ahead in a car or a Land Rover, whatever the case may be, to set up a control point. They would all land and then spring into action. Rapid reaction force, if you like.
Was this something you'd practiced before, while you were at Warminster or while
you'd
been in Germany?
No, we hadn't practiced that. We just adapted. Again, we had to react, and that was the way things were done there at that time. And it wasn't difficult. You just said, right, this is what we'll do. And we just formed people up into sticks or whatever so they could load on the right number, and then they would come back for the second shift if that was required.
You were saying that you had to keep people busy, so you were doing things like training besides the operations. What was the scope for training, and where could you do it?
We were quite lucky on the airfield. Before the prison was built, we had all the space in the world to develop ideas and what we do, and then we had to be absolutely clear about safety of weapons. We had emphasized that before we came, but we all had to set up a weapon control system that you went, you had your rifle, but it was in a secure place. You drew your rifle, then you had to sign for X number of rounds for your SLR or whatever you had. Then you had to establish a bay. Every camp had them.
Unloading bay.
Unloading bay. Mm. And they were a great big corrugated iron filled with sand, sloped and desert rose type things stuck in it. You went up, unloaded, checked your rifle before you went out, checked it when you came back. Then you had to hand in all the rounds that you had taken out, and any discrepancy had to be accounted for. Mm. So there was a strict control there. That was the routines that we had to practice there that we hadn't. We had emphasized them in Bale, but we hadn't got that particular drill, so these had to be done. And by the time you had night patrols and people out there, you settled into a routine.
When you went on patrol, did you tend to go on foot patrol or vehicle patrol?
Vehicles took you out to certain places and then you operate on the foot, or it could be just a vehicle patrol. Mm. Then in that case, you would be looking for a car number or a car. A blue Ford Sierra number so-and-so is the likely car, and then if you saw it, you reported, tried to follow it or observe it, and so on. That went on. One didn't have too much difficulty in the end of filling one's time in a useful sort of way, and people would then know that what they were doing was for a purpose. That was the important thing.
What was the strength of the normal patrol which you sent out?